Calling the House Energy Committee to order. Today is March 24th, and it is 1:04 p.m. Members present are Representative Kopp, Representative Costello, Co-Chair Mears, and myself, Co-Chair Holland. And we have a quorum to conduct business. I'd like to remind members and staff that we're allowing members to use electronic devices during committee meetings, but please silence your cell phones. As a reminder, staff and members of the audience may not approach the table. If you need to pass a note to the committee members, please get the attention of my committee aide, Tim Truer. He'll take care of it. Thank you, Tim, and thank you to Co-Chair Mears, committee aide Griffin Plush, who's in the room with us. Before we get started, I'd like to thank Recording Secretary Cheryl Cole and Renzo Moises from the Juno LIO for technical support. Our only item on the agenda today is public testimony for House Bill 369, the Energy Omnibus Bill. So we'll take up this bill for public testimony. And I just, as a brief reminder, this bill is a broad effort that provides a diversified portfolio standard for the utilities. It also has a critical new, fairly significant part of the legislation related to right-of-way vegetation management, as well as additional language related around projects. So I will go ahead and open public testimony. First off, not seeing anyone in the room to testify, we'll move on to see if there's anyone online. I do recognize we have some folks online from the RCA that I assume are available for questions. But I also see, I believe, Leanne Alexander from the American Property Casualty Insurance Association. If you're here for public testimony, would you like to introduce yourself and put yourself on the record and share your testimony?
Chairman, thank you very much. Dear Chair Holland and Mayors and members of the committee, my name is Leanne Alexander, and I'm here today representing the American Property and Casualty Insurance Association. And I do want to thank you for giving us the opportunity to testify. APCIA respectfully opposes House Bill 369 in its current form. Specifically, our concerns are with Section 2 and Section 3, the sections that address liability for electric utilities that begin fires in the state. While the language in the bill appears on its face to encourage wildfire mitigation planning, it ultimately establishes a liability framework that would significantly reduce utilities' responsibility for fires that are ignited and spread by their equipment and activities. This shifts substantial financial risk onto Alaskans. And in doing so, the bill has the perverse effect of significantly reducing utilities' incentives to take steps to enhance public safety and reduce the risk of wildfire ignition and spread. APCI strongly supports robust and well-designed wildfire mitigation plans that establish clear standards and protocols to reduce the risk of wildfire ignition spread. However, it's critical that the plans be carefully reviewed by the state's regulatory agencies, so in this case, the Department of Natural Resources, and that there exists a robust process for public engagement and input into the contents of a plan, and that there be a protocol for requiring making plan revisions. And finally, that there be meaningful state oversight and an enforcement scheme in place. And those elements, we believe, are all glaringly absent from the legislation. The language around the utility liability language and wildfire mitigation plans creates a significant amount of uncertainty and gray area. And as a result, it's difficult to interpret and anticipate how the provisions of the bill, if they ultimately become law, would apply in the case of a utility-ignited wildfire. But what is clear to us is that the bill will prove harmful to Alaskans. A legal framework that reduces utilities' consequences for failing to operate properly and maintain and repair and upgrade electric generation, transmission, and distribution equipment really does significantly increase systemic wildfire risk, and it also weakens protections for Alaska consumers because it diminishes accountability for implementing ignition-reducing technology and performing really robust vegetation management practices. So we believe that in doing all of this, House Bill 369 shifts liability away from the very entities that are best positioned to take preventive steps and onto those with the least control over the underlying hazard. So that's neither equitable nor, we believe, conducive to long-term public safety. So for these reasons, APCIA respectfully urges the House Energy Committee to oppose the bill in its current form. Yet we stand ready to work with lawmakers on balanced, effective wildfire mitigation policies that improve safety, strengthen utility responsibility, and avoid transferring wildfire-related costs onto Alaskans who are already vulnerable to escalating risk. Thank you for your time. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Alexander. Are there any questions for her? If not, I've got one. No. Thank you for joining us today. I'm curious, Ms. Alexander, you know, we have been looking at some of the legislation out of Utah, Montana, Idaho, and other states. And I'm curious, with the work you've been doing, if there are any states' legislation and approach to some of the issues that you've raised today that you feel provide an appropriate balance of liability and obligation to address some of the concerns you shared today.
Appreciate the question. And am I speaking with the chairman?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I should have introduced myself. This okay. is Representative.
Yeah, Holland. Thank you. I'm so sorry. No, it's when you're on the phone only without visual, you're never quite sure see the picture. So thank you. It's a good question. And in the seven states that passed bills last year, plus Utah already had in two different instances in 2020 and 24 passed legislation on this topic. APCIA opposes, on public policy grounds, all of those bills. We, in some instances, ended up, because of negotiation processes, going neutral on some of the final language, but not because we believe that at a public policy level it was acceptable language, but because that's simply the nature of the legislative process. But as a public policy matter, we have not found any of those bills to be an acceptable approach for the same reasons that we have concerns with this bill. We think it is flies in the face of the American legal standards that are generally applicable and have been for a very long time, and much longer probably than the United States has even been in existence, which is that people who cause harm are responsible for the harm that they cause. And that if you start a fire through your activities, your negligence, you are responsible for making people whole. And that's true across a wide range of areas, not just this. So we oppose those bills that give utilities in exchange for some level of doing what they ought to be doing anyway, which is being safe and operating in a safe manner and conducting robust vegetation management and making sure their equipment is repaired and upgraded and hardened, and that they're doing everything they can to avoid wildfires. We should believe that should be the minimal that's required, the minimum amount, the minimal standards. But we don't believe that in exchange for that, someone should then not be liable for the harm that they cause. That's simply not the standard applied in other areas in our society, and we don't believe that there should be a special pass, as it were, in this space.
Great. Thank you. And if I can follow up again, this is Representative Holland. The legislation in most of these states is pretty explicit that the utilities are being provided limited protection against fires that are caused by vegetation that did not come from their right-of-ways. And I'm curious how you see that as not being a liability shield that they should have some access to, such that if they have taken care of their right-of-ways and if the vegetation comes from outside their right-of-ways, why they should not have some protection from the lawsuits that have happened. Particularly the McKinley fire was a perfect example of a case with a fire here in Alaska that was started by a birch tree outside the right-of-way, and yet the utility ended up having to pay for some of the civil damages associated with it. And that's what I think these different bills have been addressing, is not utilities starting fires or vegetation, but external vegetation. Any more thoughts on that, on how we find that line between what you're referring to of if they start a fire, they should be responsible for it? I think we all agree with that, versus if there's a fire that they didn't have anything to do with starting.
No, it's a good question, Chairman. And I would say this, most of those bills do not attempt to spread more. It's a little difficult to be frank, to interpret all of sort of the ins and outs of the bill the way it's drafted, simply because, you know, subsection A says you're not liable. B says you are liable. C, D, and E and F provide, you know, all sort of alternate back and forth. And then subsection G has a broad, you're not liable standard again. So I will please, you know, bear with me. I'm not licensed in Alaska. So I you know, don't want to pass any, make any legal analysis here, but it's a little difficult to sort of figure out how in application that would all apply. I think you'd end up in a lot of lawsuits, to be frank. From my opinion as a non-licensed attorney there. But the rest of the bills in the other states don't do that as much. They're not, well, some of them provide language, and some drafts that didn't pass or bills that didn't pass provide language on right-of-way and vegetation management outside of the right-of-way and whether or not homeowners or landowners, you know, cleaned that up. I would say that to some extent that begs the bigger question of, is it okay to have equipment that you could have ensured would not start a fire, but you failed to do so. And during winds that were predicted or not, that caused distribution lines to snap together and spark and start a fire, does it make it okay that what happened is that spark blew 20 feet over out of your right of way and landed on a neighbor's yard or their house and started the fire? You still started the fire. Right? Because there is a way to prevent utility wildfires. You underground your lines. It's expensive, no doubt about it, but it does nearly perfectly stop utility ignited wildfires. You can also insulate the wires, still expensive, but far less than undergrounding them. And that significantly reduces the opportunity for wildfires. If that's still something that people don't think matches the cost-benefit analysis that they're running, you can institute public safety power shutoffs. Nobody likes losing their power, but I would suspect most people, if properly educated, would prefer losing their power. And there are ways you can supply generators and do things for people that are in high-risk personal situations, health risks, things like that. But you can proactively shut off the power when the weather conditions and the humidity levels and the drought conditions are such that a fire is likely. Beyond that, you can use EPS, which shuts off the power if there's any kind of fault in the line. So you can tell that two wires have snapped together, some other fault's been detected, you can cut off the electricity then. You can remove transmission lines that are not being used, which is what started the Eaton fire by all accounts. So there are a lot of things that can be done to stop fires, and embers can travel miles. So if a spark happens because of your equipment or your practices, and I would say there we're talking about equipment, not their specific vegetation management practices, should they be off the hook simply because that didn't land? Maybe they had mowed right underneath, but there was still a tree nearby or something. I mean, that's going to happen. There are going to be trees and there's going to be grass and things are going to catch in the wind and go. But if you could have prevented starting the fire in the first place, we would argue that you should be held responsible for having started it. If it was your equipment, it was your equipment. Now, if it was someone driving down the road who flicked a cigarette out the window and that caught fire, we're not arguing that should be captured by this bill. But if it's your lines that caused the fire, distribution lines, transmission lines, somehow your generation facilities, then there should be liability that attaches to that.
Great. Thank you for that. Representative Mears?
Thank you. Through the chair to Ms. Alexander. We do have a couple other testifiers online, so I don't want to take too long here, but I want to specifically ask a question about property owners and their responsibility for danger trees. I know that just anecdotally, and insurance is not my area of specialty, but anecdotally, the requirements for insurance companies on homeowners for having inspections and doing things around their house is increased significantly for, you know, like overhanging branches and those sorts of things with site inspections. Are danger trees for entanglement and potential fires from electrical lines something that homeowner insurance companies are looking for and requiring homeowners to resolve for their policies?
That is a very good question, Representative, and one that I unfortunately don't feel, I don't want to give you a wrong answer, and I'm not 100% certain of what the right answer is. And my suspicion, but we can follow up. That said, we will follow up. But my suspicion is that that changes insurer by insurer, right? And perhaps state by state, depending on the wildfire risk and other exposures. But I can say this. The Institute for Business and Home Safety has a wildfire community plan. There are IBHS standards on fire-safe homes. And we really, really strongly support those measures. And in some states, there are requirements on the books that if actuarially justified and if a homeowner has come into compliance and gotten a wildfire, and in most states, to be honest, it's not wildfire certified yet. It's the fortified homes in states with hurricane exposure and tornado exposure. Oklahoma, Alabama, Louisiana, several other states have adopted the IBHS standards and said if you build your home to a certification standard, some of those states have laws on the books now that say an insurer has to take that into consideration and if actuarially justified, give some kind of a rate consideration. And other states have created tax advantage savings accounts that say if a homeowner wants to retrofit to meet one of these standards, they can save a certain amount of money tax free to go towards paying for that. There are, you know, state grant programs that do the same thing. Oklahoma has very proudly been, and that's my home state, so I can say this, publishing online that the Department of Insurance put in a hail or wind resistant roof and has met the IBHS standard, I think it was on that, and that they have now what's called the Safe Oklahoma Homes Program. So we really support resilience and mitigation. What individual insurers do with regard to inspection of a home prior to either issuing the policy or renewing, I truly can't speak to today, and I apologize for that. But what I can say is that there are a lot of programs out there adopted by states, publicly available. I'm in the process of building a smaller home, and in doing so, I'm making sure mine meets those standards from IBHS that are available online, and I'm making sure that my vents don't suck embers in, and that I don't have a wooden fence within 5 feet of my home. So there are things that homeowners can do separate and apart from what an insurer may require. But again, we can follow up with you on that. I'll try to do some research and find out, but I do suspect that the answer is it varies widely by insurer, by area, by type of coverage sought perhaps. But and I'm sorry, I don't have a more definitive answer, but I can tell you there are a lot of standards out there that are helpful.
That's been great, Ms. Alexander. Thank you for being here. We're going to continue on to a couple other folks that are joining us. If you get a chance, you might just stay with us, Ms. Alexander, in case we want to come back to anything. But let's continue on for now. And next in the queue, we've got, looks like, Declan Farr with the Alaska Center. I assume, is that Mr. Farr, I hope I've gotten that right. Are you online and can you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Yes, hello. Declan Farr with the Alaska Center for the Environment. I'm the Climate and Clean Energy Program Manager here. Thank you very much for hearing me today. As you know, we're in an energy crisis and it's important to move forward on energy issues. However, we believe that this bill is not the right venue. It would be better to address the issues presented in this bill separately so that there can be dedicated public input on each piece. Specifically, we oppose a definition of diverse energy that includes, and in some cases we believe favors, continued reliance on fossil fuels. It's very important for our energy to become renewable and sustainable. On the other hand, we support things like net metering and plug-in solar as popular, broadly supported avenues for bringing distributed energy onto our grids. So we hope that the committee will consider advancing individual aspects of this legislation in order to move the needle forward, while providing adequate public input and process. So thank you for your time and consideration.
Great. Thank you for your comments there. Representative Kopp.
Yes, Mr. Farr, thank you for your testimony, sir. I missed the definition of the term that you wanted us to take another look at. Which term was it that you opposed the definition of?
Defining diverse energy as including fossil fuel sources, like natural gas. And I believe that there's provisions about carbon dioxide emissions as well.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for that response. Any other questions for Mr. Farr at the moment? All right. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Farr. I appreciate your thoughts on the bill. Continuing on, then, we have Christian Rataj. I apologize if I haven't gotten that quite right. He is online with the National Association of Mutual Insurance Companies. If you could put yourself on the record, I'd appreciate your feedback and testimony on our bill.
Good afternoon, Chair Holland and honorable committee members. My name is Christian Rataj, spelled R-A-T-A-J, and I am with the National Association of Mutual Insurance Companies. NAMIC is opposed to the utilities liability sections of HB 369 for many reasons. A number of those were clearly and effectively articulated by Ms. Alexander of APCIA, so I won't repeat her. But I am going to limit my comments to two bedrock principles that I think are very important from a public policy standpoint. And they're bedrock principles of our society, and that is promoting public safety and accountability and responsibility. We teach our children to be accountable and responsible. It's also part of our proud legal tradition. We tell our kids, if you hurt someone, if you damage their property, even by accident, you must be accountable for it. You don't get a pass. You don't get any liability sweetheart deal. The proposed utilities liability protection is contrary to this basic societal concept, this basic societal agreement that we all have. It is ultimately a shifting of utilities financial responsibility onto homeowners, businesses, and insurance consumers. Many are people who are least experienced with no subject matter expertise on wildfire risk mitigation or prevention, and people least capable of being able to do it, like people who own property and may be elderly or may not have the ability to do the analysis that the utilities can on these risks. The bill basically says, utilities, you get limited liability if you do what you should already be doing, which is to protect others from wildfire risk based upon your business model. You know, how does limiting utilities' incentive to be proactive in their risk mitigation promote public safety? We all know that when you have economic skin in the game, you're vigilant. That's just the way human nature is. Now, the current negligence law only holds utilities liable for damages if they are negligent. There is no strict liability in the state. That was done away with in the 1990s. So the utilities already, in effect, have limited liability. Just act as a reasonably prudent utility when it comes to addressing foreseeable wildfire risk, and you have no legal liability. There is no need for this complex and convoluted change in the law, a change that only impacts them, doesn't protect anybody else, just gives them illegal liability protection. Now, commercial truck drivers, hotels, restaurants, and every other business individual in the state is required to be fully responsible and accountable for their negligence. They don't get a sweetheart deal. Commercial truck drivers don't get a legal presumption of no fault by following the rules of the road or complying with federal transportation laws. They have to do what they have to do because that's the social contract. You can't expose others to unreasonable risk. Why do utilities get a special preferential legal treatment when everybody else does not get such a privilege? It's not good for society. Moreover, this bill makes the very wildfire mitigation plan requirements nebulous, as there are no specific wildfire science-based standards articulated. There's no clear third-party accountability. As Ms. Alexander had mentioned, the whole liability structure of this bill is confusing. It starts off with a granting of immunity, and then it says, well, but there is civil liability if the following, Then it goes on and says, well, but this liability is qualified with a legal presumption, which gives you a huge legal advantage in the lawsuits. Oh, and by the way, if you kill someone, non-economic damages, you have to be grossly negligent. Regular negligence doesn't matter. So if you take someone's brother or sister from them because you were negligent, they don't get any non-economic damages unless the utility was grossly negligent. We don't give those protections to other people, other businesses. Why? Because it's not good public policy. Once again, how does this bill really reduce wildfire risk? It doesn't. This bill is about protecting utilities' financial bottom line. It's about promoting public safety. If it was, it would be all about things like the IBHS standards and other mitigation science-based proposals on how better to prevent and reduce risk management and mitigate risk of loss. So for the following reasons, we respectfully say, please vote no and protect your citizens from wildfire risk. This bill just doesn't do that. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments today. Are there any questions or follow-up? Very good. Thank you for joining us today with those comments, a valuable perspective on this issue. To the committee, any other follow-up comments for anybody? We've got the folks we've had online. We also had the RCA joining us if there's anything else you want to follow up on today. No. All right. So with that, I will close public testimony. We didn't get anybody else online, did they? Okay. So public testimony is closed on House Bill 369. Thank you for the time on that. If any of you that are potentially listening to this still have any written testimony, you can email that in to house.energy@akledge.gov. That's akleg.gov. And at this point in time for today, we're now going to set this bill aside, and that will conclude our business for today. On Thursday, we have a presentation on the Alaska Energy Data Gateway from ASEP. Seeing no further business before the committee, this meeting will be adjourned now at 1:30. Thank you.